Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Chanting "Burn in Hell Abu Musab al-Zarqawi," hundreds of Jordanians took to the streets in Amman today to protest yesterday's three nearly simultaneous suicide bombings. The attacks in hotels owned by Western chains wounded around 100 people and left at least 56 dead, among them one American. Most of the dead were Jordanians, including the fathers of both the bride and the groom celebrating their wedding at one of the hotels. In an internet posting that can't be verified, Al-Qaeda in Iraq claimed responsibility for the bombings, saying Jordan had turned into a backyard for enemies of the faith. Well, joining us on the line is terrorism expert Daniel Benjamin, who was director of counterterrorism at the National Security Council in the late 1990s. Dan, what is your take on these attacks? If Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was responsible, what does that mean?
I think there's a good to very good chance that he was responsible. Zarqawi has been targeting Jordanian sites since, I believe, 1999. He comes from Jordan. He harbors enormous animosity for the regime there. And, you know, there has been some spillover effect from Iraq already. So it is quite plausible that he is behind these. And remember that the principal target in the Millennium plot that was disrupted in Jordan was the Radisson Hotel.
And again, al-Zarqawi was considered to be the man behind that foiled attack. Well, and what further does this mean to you? Does this mean that the war in Iraq is spreading into Jordan, a strong U.S. ally?
Well, again, we don't know that it's Zarqawi, but if it is, then it is another bit of evidence that the conflict is going beyond Iraq's borders. Now, I have talked to bomb experts who have told me of bombings that have been done in Saudi Arabia that were using techniques that had only been used in Iraq and never been used in Saudi Arabia. We know that there's been a lot of unrest, a number of arrests in Kuwait associated with the war in Iraq. We've also had the first suicide bombing ever in the small Gulf country of Qatar not long ago. So this is, very dangerous and worrisome development.
Well, and I'm wondering, do you think these bombings will force any reconsideration of the relationship between the King of Jordan and the U.S.? And by the way, remind us what that relationship is.
Well, the relationship is very close, has been very close for many years. It was close during the reign of the current King Abdullah's father, King Hussein. No, I don't think this will cause any reconsideration. In fact, it will, if anything, just make the ties tighter. First of all, the intelligence ties between the Jordanian intelligence service, the GID, and the CIA are very close, and that's certainly no secret. And the government itself is very close. In fact, there are times when government officials in the United States will occasionally wonder how King Abdullah can be as close as he is to the United States, given the unpopularity of the United States at this moment.
Jordan also signed a 1994 peace treaty with Israel. But I'm wondering if this relatively stable country, if there is a crackdown on al-Qaeda potentially now in Jordan, will there be a backlash there?
Unlikely. The law enforcement and intelligence authorities have had numerous crackdowns on extremists, and this is not a negotiable policy for the government there because their existence depends on it. There is no compromising with the people who carried out this attack, as far as they're concerned.
Well, in a possibly related story, two suicide bombers killed at least 33 people, mostly Iraqis, in Baghdad today. We know the U.S. military is continuing to battle insurgents along the border with Syria. What is your assessment? These bombings yesterday and today, do they reflect a strong insurgency or one in the last gasps?
Well, there's no question that the insurgency remains quite strong and that its death has been prematurely announced many times by the administration. The interesting thing is that the number of suicide attacks has, over the last few years, just gone up and up and up. And earlier this year, in 1 month, I believe, there were more suicide attacks in Iraq than there had been in the entire Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Thank you, Daniel. Daniel Benjamin, currently a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and co-author of the new book, The Next Attack, The Failure of the War on Terror and the Strategy for Getting It Right. Well, tomorrow is Veterans Day, a day set aside to honor the veterans of all wars, and there is much to reflect on this year, what with the U.S. military death toll in Iraq now rising over 2,000. But there are still places, especially in the South, where veterans of the Civil War are still honored. Over 600,000 Americans from both sides of that conflict died in that war, and Abraham Lincoln seemed to bear the grief of the whole nation. Someone once said of Abraham Lincoln, the melancholy seemed to roll from his shoulders and drip from the ends of his fingers. Well, now a fascinating new book called Lincoln's Melancholy treats that aspect of Lincoln's character. It paints a portrait of a troubled man, but also a great leader who rose up to bind the nation's wounds during the Civil War, despite his own wounds. The author is Joshua Schenck, and he joins us to talk more about it. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And we understand that Lincoln's moods, his melancholy, were sort of airbrushed from the scholarly study of his life up until about two decades ago. So tell us, what do you mean by melancholy? When did it start? What did it look and feel like?
It starts in Lincoln's life when he's in his mid-20s. He had this spectacular collapse, and it's what you might call a nervous breakdown, or what clinicians would call a major depression. Mm-hmm. It was, his friends thought that he was going crazy. And they used that kind of extreme language because he was so distressed that he was talking about killing himself. And they took him seriously and locked him up, one said. They had a suicide watch. They physically kept him from hurting himself.
And the common story is this is because his first love, Ann Rutledge, died. It's such a painful thing to read. He couldn't bear, and someone can identify with this, he couldn't bear the thought of rain falling on her grave.
That is indeed what was said, and the funeral of Ann Rutledge was the time when he really, really, when the collapse began. Lincoln himself thought that he had a temperamental condition, a temperamental inclination towards these somber moods, and that could tip over into these severe spells if the right exacerbants or the wrong exacerbants came together. Mm-hmm. And in fact, those did come together two times very dramatically. Once in 1835 when he was 26, and 6 years later, another very similar collapse.
Well, tell us about that date as well. Was this the January 1841 date, which is considered so important? What happened?
All kinds of things were going wrong for Lincoln. His political career was in real trouble. His legal career was in a major transition. And his social life, his personal life, was in complete disarray. And all these things came together around what Lincoln called the fatal 1st of January, 1841. He ended up missing work for 10 days or so, and he ended up being trusted to the care of a physician who probably did him more harm than good. When he came out of that treatment, he declared that he was the most miserable man living.
Well, tell us a little bit about that, because it does sound horrific. Hypochondriasm is what he was treated for. Is that true? And it involved rubbing things on his body. And tell us more.
Well, the treatment for, many medical conditions was kind of barbaric at that time. Mercury and bleeding, and leaching and hot baths followed by cold baths and so forth. But the most interesting thing is that this episode was kind of the end of this first phase of his melancholy, in which he was often collapsing and going about telling people how distressed he was. But he really, after that, devoted himself to taking care of himself in the face of this suffering, and he very deliberately began to devise and put into practice these strategies to live a healthy life, even though he knew that he was always going to be prone to such suffering.
Well, in fact, some are saying that perhaps because of this suffering, this dark cloud that he knew he had, he did become a great leader. I mean, one reviewer of your book has said it seems it would have been difficult for a cheery person to become the Lincoln we knew.
Lincoln's melancholy is so intertwined with his character that it is hard to imagine that if this aspect of him were not there, that he would have done what he did. There are three key aspects to it. Number one, Lincoln had this keen, piercing insight into the nature of things. He looked cold, hard, difficult, scary reality straight in the face, and he was eager to do that, and he was eager to help other people see it. And this was related to his ability to do that in his own life. He faced the hardest questions for himself, questions of life and death, questions of what is this for, what do we live for? And he was able to do that for the nation when the time came. Mm. He also responded to adversity creatively. He was always looking for a way to find some meaning in extremely perilous events. And finally, he had a remarkably deep spiritual sense that combined a really profound determination with a profound humility that manifested itself dramatically and beautifully in his later years.
Right. In fact, this same reviewer, I'm speaking of Andrew Solomon in The New Yorker, who reviewed your book, he said he didn't think we would have had the Emancipation Proclamation or the Gettysburg Address in the same exquisite energy. And as you said, that sort of, passion, depth, if he hadn't had the, if he hadn't walked to the abyss, as he had. And we see it in some of his letters. I know you have one in front of you that he wrote to a young woman. Can you tell us a little bit about her, and then maybe we can hear from the letter?
Sure. Fannie McCullough was a young woman who whose father died in the Civil War. He was in a battle in Mississippi. And Lincoln was connected to her through some political friends in Illinois. And this young woman was severely troubled. Anyone who lost a father would be upset. But this woman, when she heard the news, went to her room and shut the door and wouldn't come out. And she was known to her friends and family to have a nervous condition. They were very worried about her, and they thought that a letter from the president might help. And he wrote her a letter in the midst of one of the most trying times of his presidency, one of the most trying times in the history of statecraft and politics. The nation was falling apart. People thought that Washington, D.C. itself might fall to the Confederacy, and that Lincoln might even be overthrown in a coup. And in the midst of this, he writes this letter on December 23rd, 1862, and he writes, "Dear Fannie, it is with deep grief that I learn of the death of your kind and brave father, and especially that it is affecting your young heart beyond what is common in such cases. In this sad world of ours, sorrow comes to all, and to the young it comes with bitterest agony because it takes them unawares. The older have learned to ever expect it. I am anxious to afford some alleviation of your present distress. Perfect relief is not possible except with time. You cannot now realize that you will ever feel better. Is not this so? And yet it is a mistake. You are sure to be happy again. To know this, which is certainly true, will make you some less miserable now. I have had experience enough to know what I say, and you need only to believe it to feel better at once. The memory of your dear father, instead of an agony, will yet be a sad, sweet feeling in your heart of a purer and holier sort than you have ever known before."
And Lincoln signs that letter, "Please present my kind regards to your afflicted mother, your sincere friend, A. Lincoln." That letter is included in the new book, Lincoln's Melancholy. We've been speaking with the author, Joshua Schenck, and we're going to do more of that after a quick break. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. Speaking with author Joshua Schenck. His new book is Lincoln's Melancholy. It tells the story of the 16th president's struggle with depression and how that struggle affected, perhaps even enhanced, his leadership. And Joshua, we're reminded in your book of Lincoln's way with words. I'm thinking of some of them, such as "Better Angels of Our Nature" in his first inaugural address, where he clearly seems to be drawing on his own experience, trying to keep his own demons away as well. Did he write that phrase?
"Better Angels of Our Nature" was Lincoln's phrase. He used it to replace a phrase that was written for him by his Secretary of State. The phrase was "Guardian Angel of the Nation." And they're very similar phrases in the sense that they both evoke a deity, asking this deity to sort of bring forth something better. But the idea of "better angels of our nature" suggests that individuals are full of complexity, that there are better angels and there are worse angels, and the worst ones aren't going to go away, that there's this conflict that's always happening, and it's a matter of prevailing with what's better in us, searching and struggling and finding something better. And indeed, this was at the core of Lincoln's personal philosophy and his political philosophy, that the world and that individuals in it is radically imperfect, but that we can move towards something better. Mm-hmm. And it comes by first recognizing the imperfection, recognizing the difficulty, which he did in his personal life and later in his political life, by finding disciplined ways to grow and to endure, which he did in both, and finally by articulating that core meaning, that core purpose, which was Lincoln's great contribution not only to the American experiment but to democracy and freedom throughout the world.
Joshua Shank, again, author of Lincoln's Melancholy, and I'm sitting here thinking, you know from whence you speak. You did amazing research at one point putting on a Lincoln suit and joining a convention of Lincoln lookalikes, but some research you just happen to be living. You also suffered from depression.
I have, and it was at the beginning of the study, I wanted to write something about mental health and mental illness, because I have this intellectual fascination with such states, and also I thought that doing this might help me become in contact with people who have shared similar experiences of mine. I have a very strong intuitive connection to Lincoln, but the struggle of the book was to tell the story not from my perspective, not from any modern perspective, but principally from Lincoln's perspective, by gathering together all of this material, Lincoln's own words, the things that Lincoln's friends and colleagues said about him, and making sense of that, occasionally drawing on modern research, but principally drawing on the time and tenor and culture of his time, which proves to be a really surprising and challenging story.
Well, I'm just wondering, as you became convinced of this, you know, deep melancholy that you think Lincoln suffered, what were you feeling? Were you feeling, you know, identifying with him, feeling badly for him, feeling, well, that's a good example of how someone can live with this? I mean, was he inspirational? What were you feeling?
Oh, all those things. The story is a dark one, and it gets darker and darker and darker as this young man who faced personal demons and comes to some peace with them but continues to struggle in obscurity, longing for some role in the affairs of the nation. And then he finally finds it, and the world, the country starts to crack apart, and he's standing on that divide, and he's trying to bridge it, and he finds himself at the helm of this awful war. So it's a very dark story, but it's also an inspirational one, because the movement of Lincoln through his life provides structure and guidance for us in our ordinary mundane lives. The way that he acknowledged his difficulty and spoke about it plainly and clearly, the way that he dedicated himself to this discipline of learning to live with his suffering, and the way that he searched for meaning in the face of his own suffering and in the national suffering, that is extraordinarily helpful to me, and it continues to bear fruit in all kinds of surprising ways.
One takeaway from it is that Abe Lincoln might have been comfortable there, because, as you said, he had been there in his own head and knew he could come out the other side.
He often collapsed in the midst of the difficulty of the war, and yet he would collapse and he would always return to the dutiful work of managing the army, managing the executive branch, and he would always return to this desire to find the meaning in the midst of the conflict and to articulate that to his fellow countrymen and to inspire them to do what he thought was the right thing, all the while recognizing that he might be wrong, that it might not be the right thing, but acting as best he could in this place of humility.
Well, Joshua Shank, I guess I just finally want to ask you, ultimately, what are you saying? Because especially since you have suffered from depression, you also, I'm sure, don't want to leave listeners with this romantic notion that, you know, this sometimes horribly debilitating illness is okay because then you get to write the Gettysburg Address. I mean,
oh, no, yeah. Definitely not. I want to show people something about the way that life really happens, and I don't think I'm romanticizing depression, because, you know, the the story is just so awful. And some of the same people who've said, well, this is a kind of romantic story, have also, you know, said that it's, that there's just too much gloom and doom. The thing is that these things run together, and it's something that people who suffer and who manage to live a life with that suffering know intuitively, that our greatest strengths and our greatest abilities are often part of the same story. I'm trying to point out both aspects, and if to, you know, point out the strength is inspiring to people, that doesn't negate the fact that it comes along with this profound plague. Mm. I mean, on the last day of Lincoln's life, he had won the war, and he was in the midst of this great triumph, and there's this really poignant scene right before he went to the theater. This bodyguard who was with him said that he, you know, was walking back from the War Department, and he, you know, just had this really sad, depressed look on his face. And he came out of it again, and he did go to the theater. But the point is that you know, in his life, these two things are intertwined. And if we're to accept him as a great man, it may help us to also accept the way that these things are combined and connected in our own lives.
Joshua Shank, author of Lincoln's Melancholy, How Depression Challenged a President and Fueled His Greatness. Joshua, thanks so much.
Well, thank you. It's been a great conversation.
And this note, tomorrow we'll look at Civil War battlefields then and now. Much more ahead, here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from cardiovascular disease is the number one killer of women in the U.S. But there's still a perception that heart disease is a man's problem, to the extent that women at high risk for heart attack and stroke don't get the same medical attention as men. That's the finding of the largest international study of its kind by researchers in Canada. And we're joined on the line by the study's lead author, Dr. Sonia Anand, an associate professor of medicine at McMaster University in Ontario. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And tell us, what exactly is the difference in treatment? Is there a place where it's most observable?
Yes, we were studying a condition called acute coronary syndromes, which is like a bad case of angina or chest pain that takes someone to the hospital. And we noticed the biggest difference in treatment was that women are not referred as frequently for a procedure called an angiogram of their coronary arteries compared to men.
Then the angiogram is what?
The angiogram is a test by which dye is shot through the arteries supplying the heart, and it can tell you how much blockage there is in those arteries. Mm-hmm. If there is significant blockage, then people usually go on to an angioplasty or sometimes bypass surgery of the heart arteries.
So what are these women told who go into the emergency rooms with chest pains or difficulty breathing? What are some of the other symptoms, and what are they told?
Well, you know, in our study, this was a clinical trial, so all of our patients had a lot of tests that are commonly performed, like an electrocardiogram and some blood tests. And what we did in our study is say, take all of that information and divide women and men into low-risk, intermediate-risk, and high-risk patients, because it's sometimes appropriate for a low-risk patient or someone who doesn't really have serious chest pain to not have these types of procedures. So we were particularly interested in what happens to the highest-risk group. And even in the highest-risk group, men are more often referred to have this test than women.
Well, so, and these women in the high-risk groups, perhaps they have, you know, parents who've had heart attacks or have you know, knowledge that they, you know, have high cholesterol or whatever,
right.
I'm
yes.
guessing here, right? Are they told to go home? Are they told that it's gas? Or are they told, you know, to come back if it persists?
It's difficult to know. We didn't record the factors associated with the patient's perspective on things or the physician's perspective on things. We just recorded what happened to
right.
the patient. So that is a big question mark that future studies will have to address. Why does this lower rate of referral occur?
What are some of your thoughts about why this happens?
Probably the biggest possible reasons are, one, there is a perception among physicians that women don't develop heart disease or don't have complications of heart disease, so they may tend to take the symptoms that women present with less seriously than in a man. So that is the physician's bias, potentially. It may also be, however, that women's symptoms are different, so perhaps they do report symptoms that sound more like an upset stomach than typical angina chest pain.
Right.
It also may be that women refuse to go to have these procedures compared to men. And there are some small studies done a number of years ago where women tended to refuse to have an angiogram or an invasive procedure because it would take additional time away from their families.
Do women tend to, I mean, historically, this tends to happen, so I'm wondering, do they tend to just think, well, the doctor, who's usually male, must know what he's talking about, and so they don't question it?
I think in North America, the healthcare system is still set up so that patients trust what the physicians say, so they'll just go along with what the physician in the hospital says. And and it's good to have trust between a patient and a physician, but I think, you know, when women can say, what can we learn from this type of study, what can be learned is when a woman is in hospital with chest pain, she should ask questions about, you know, do I need any additional tests?
Mm. You also mentioned that women tend to present differently when it comes to heart attack. I know my mom, when she had her second heart attack, everyone around her thought it was a flu because she was sweating and, and she didn't have the typical numbness in her left arm or the things that you hear about. She looked like she was having the flu.
Right, and that is sometimes a difficult situation because the symptoms sound like something else, so people may tend to say, well, it's probably something else. But in our study, we looked at objective things. So when patients came back to hospital with chest pain, they had to also have abnormalities on their electrocardiogram or changes in their blood tests. So we believe that the symptoms that we were looking at were really anginal chest pain. And despite that, and despite that objective evidence that it's the heart, women were referred less often than men.
Mm. And by the way, once women are referred to the angioplasty and they get on the, you know, the treadmill, if you will, towards the procedures, are they treated the same as men?
Yeah, what we did find is that once women had the test, so if the trigger were pulled, so to speak, to send the woman for the test, if significant coronary artery disease was found, then women were as likely to go on to have an angioplasty or bypass surgery if they needed it compared to men. Mm-hmm. So what we have to work on in the healthcare field is making sure that the same percentage of women are sent for this angiography test compared to men, especially in the high-risk group.
Doctor, what are you going to do next? Can you be specific about what you're going to study now?
Yes, well, we're very interested in this issue of physician referral bias. Does it exist? And what we're doing is creating a number of scenarios where we've created women and men who are of equal risk, and we're going to have this on a web-based survey. We're going to send it to a number of cardiologists and internists around the country, those who are recent graduates from medical school, those who are older, those who are in smaller centers, those who are in teaching centers, to really figure out who is it. Is it the older physician who graduated 40 years ago who still believes that women are low risk for this condition, or are there other factors? So that's our next step.
Dr. Sonia Anand, Associate Professor of Medicine at McMaster University in Ontario, Canada. Doctor, thank you.
You're welcome.
And this note, Judith Miller, the veteran New York Times reporter who spent 85 days in jail for refusing to reveal her source in the Valerie Plame case, is leaving her job at the paper. Miller finally decided to reveal her source, Louis Scooter Libby, after hearing from him, and she testified before the grand jury in the case. But she came under attack by editors and other reporters at the Times, who were also critical of her past reporting, which suggested that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction. Judith Miller worked at that paper for 28 years, most recently covering national security issues, and by her own account was a free-spirited reporter. She called herself Miss Run Amok, and had both admirers and critics who felt she was too cozy with her sources. Well, Judith Miller wrote in a letter published in today's edition that she could no longer report the news because she had become the news. She said she was now freed from the New York Times, or as she called it, the convent, with its own theology and its own catechism. Stay tuned. For Jerry Lewis, you're listening to Here and Now. Recently, hundreds of his fans crowded a Boston University auditorium to worship at the altar of Jerry Lewis.
The expression was never, "Hey, lady," ever. It was just, "Lady!"
That's true.
For a full 2 hours, Jerry Lewis answered every audience question, and some of mine as well. Although as the MC of the evening, I sometimes felt like the straight man in a vaudeville act.
Before we leave the physicality of it,
Wait a minute. Who told you I was finished?
Sorry.
What the hell is the matter with you?
So sorry.
Well, after all, Jerry Lewis is the king of comedy, one of the most wildly successful names in show business history. And for 10 years, Jerry and Dean Martin were the highest paid and arguably one of the most successful comedy teams ever, with films, a TV show, and sold-out performances at clubs like the Copa.
I'm proud of my partner because he's very talented, and his talent is only exceeded by his alimony. My good partner, Mr. Dean Martin. Here he is.
Well, now Jerry Lewis has written a new memoir about those days. It's called Dean and Me, A Love Story, a story ultimately of heartbreak, but one that begins with a 19-year-old Jerry, raised in the Borscht Belt by vaudevillians, taking on New York.
When we meet you at the beginning of the book, you're 19 years old, married, with a baby, skinny. You wanted so badly to be famous that it affected your breathing.
Yeah, when you thought about it enough, and when you had the kind of a father I had, who did it all and did it so magnificently, and to watch him as your teacher, I'm still working desperately to match what he did, and I'm never going to make it.
I mentioned the skinny, 6-inch pompadour, peg leg, tight pants,
oh, Jesus.
Rubber face. You're doing sort of a lip-syncing act?
It was called a dumb act. Because I never spoke. I did an impression of Frank. I had the hair. I had enough pomade in there to move the population of Pasadena down a slope. And I did Il Bacio the Kiss, Lily Pons with a fright wig on. I was the intermission act. And if you don't speak on stage, it's referred to as a dumb act.
Well, then there comes one day, cue the choir singing and the clouds part and the sunshaft comes down on a street in New York and you see Dean Martin.
And he walked across the street and he had a camel's hair coat on, wraparound belt, very casual. But he looked like an Adonis. He had come from Florida. He was tan, had his new nose. He was handsome. And the first thing that struck me was, God, I wish he was my friend. I remember thinking that. It was just something wonderful about him. And it happened. We met. Our friendship really built quickly, but we never got together theatrically for another 6-7 months.
Right. You had acts that were back-to-back at a small club, and you started interacting a little bit between the acts, but you weren't really in an act together.
No. No, I decided one night to give him a spritz. He was doing a lovely love song, Where or When, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It was perfect. I put on a busboy's jacket, and I began to rattle the front table. And that was the first time I was awestruck when he stopped singing, and he said, "And I suppose you'd like to be in show business too, huh?" I never heard such a feed line in my life. I did something. I motivated his next move, and he said, "Come up here. If you think it's so easy, stand over there and do it. Sing something." I said, "What the hell are you talking about? I can't sing." He says, "You can make a lot of noise." "Yeah, okay." Whatever the hell happened in that first 5 minutes started something. Because when we were through, he came to my dressing room, which was a nail. He said, "You were magical talking." I said, "Well, I never do that. You know, I do my act. It's dumb." He said, "But something happens. There's more than just miming." And I loved what I heard because nobody had ever been that supportive.
The beginning of a love story. More of our conversation with comedian Jerry Lewis coming up. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now.
Thank you.
As a solo act in the 50s and 60s, Jerry Lewis broke box office records, had top 10 hits, but before that, for 10 years, he and Dean Martin were partners. At their first gig together at a small club in Atlantic City in the mid-40s, the mobster owners told them to make it funny or else. So Jerry mapped out a strategy. He still has the sandwich bag that started it all and served as their notepad that night.
And I took the pastrami sandwich out of the bag and I ripped it in the center. And it had the grease spots on it, but I took a makeup pencil and I marked one. Do the side-by-side bit. Everything I remembered my dad do in burlesque. I wrote a list of 8 or 9 items. I told him what I would do, where he'd have the chance to respond. We did 2 hours and 20 minutes to an audience of 11 people. By the fifth night, we had 1,000 people around the block. For Dean, he knew that we had lightning in a bottle. I knew that I had come across a genius, and I couldn't believe what we had.
You went to New York, and, you know, pandemonium, hilarity ensues. But what you're doing in this act is parting your hair down the middle, popping in the buck teeth, running around while he's singing, taking people's food, spritzing people, cutting off people's ties. Were you ever afraid the audience would sue you? What you did to that audience?
I had people sitting ringside that came there to get their ties cut. When we opened at the Copa, Milton Berle would sit at the center table of Lindy's with every comic in New York. And he said simply, most of you guys have seen them. Is someone going to tell me what the hell they do? He said, so far I hear a handsome guy that sings nice, and a monkey. What was happening was this simple. One guy says, did you take a bath this morning? And the kid says, why, is there one missing? You don't make $200 million with that material. Then what is it? They wanted to see two men who loved one another, and were doing something that they were paid a lot of money for and having the goddamnedest good time. Audiences identified with what they knew the world needed now. We lost kids in the war. We weren't sure what the hell was happening in the Pacific. 45, everybody was really walking around, thrilled that it was all over, but what do we do now? And we, as though God said, here's a very good time to bring them out.
After your films, the critics loved you, and they didn't get Dean. Sometimes called him the empty suit. Do you think that was the beginning of the break?
Oh, God, no.
What was?
Oh, no. The break was just a bunch of people on the outside looking at two people in love, and they're going to divide them.
What, whispering to him?
No, just saying to me, you know, you could do it all by yourself. And all of a sudden, that little poison drip gets in there, and someone is saying to him, what do you need him for? And that little drop is in there. And before you know it, you're buying into it. You don't even know how that happened. How could they destroy this love? It's easy. Very easy. You drop your guard when you're in love.
The whole country seemed to be watching and holding their breath when you actually did break up.
When we split up, we received about 900,000 letters. What right do you have to spoil what we loved? When Frank Sinatra brought Dean on the telethon in 1976, Dean and I hadn't talked for 20 years. That was, of course, a case of stupidity, but that's what happened. Frank finishes the number. He says, Jerry, I want you to know, a friend of mine loves what you do. He just came over with me. Could I bring him out? Come on out here, pal. And he strolls out. Oy, this handsome Adonis with his cigarette and the tan and the high collar. And I say to myself, dear God, give me something to say. And I looked at him and I said, how you been? And now there's a slight pause, and I said, you working? And then his son was killed in an airplane accident. I called my wife. I said, honey, my partner died today. The light of his life was Dino. And when he lost him, I knew it was a matter of time. He let himself go. He drank like everybody thought he did in his career, which he didn't. And he was waiting to die. So I'm on the phone with him now. I said, Dean, please listen to me. I never called him Dean. I called him Paul, which is his real name. I said, Paul, please listen to me. There's a lot of life left here. There's a lot of things we can do. There's a lot of children that love you. And for Christ's sakes, you know what you mean to me. Don't you feel kind of special with all that love and adulation? Jared, look, I love two men in my life, Dino and you. Now, that's the first time I had ever heard him express love. We get through talking, and I get a letter, which he's never done. And he wrote in the letter, this was the time for me to tell you, I never stopped loving you. I'm sorry for whatever we did to one another, and I love you very much, and I'll try to get through this like a man. It took 4 years, but he died. But what he did while he was here was so much more, so that the day Dean died, Christmas of 95, I sat down at the typewriter that night, and I was going to tell the jerks that never recognized what he was, and I told them that they have to remember, not only was he the best recording artist in the last few years of his life, he made a couple of films like Some Came Running and The Young Lions, and you got to look at a man that was nominated for an Oscar. You also have to recognize that if he wasn't there, I would have been a record act. Nothing more. He was the magic. He was the center point. And I'm living with this all these years. I needed to get it out. I needed to almost do penance for the 10 years he took of being disregarded or thought of lightly. How can you look at that crazy maniac and not see that the strings are in Dean's hands? I'm not being overly humble. I know how goddamn good I am, and I know how goddamn funny I can be, but with him, it was just a little better. And without him, I'm still working at it. But I'll be all right.
Jerry Lewis speaking at Boston University at a recent event hosted by Barnes & Noble at BU. Jerry's new memoir is called Dean and Me, A Love Story. We leave you with a recording from the 40s of Martin and Lewis at the Copa 60 years ago. Stay tuned. Our full interview, including audience questions, will be on our website very soon. And by the way, people have asked, how'd he look? Well, after overcoming severe back pain, a subsequent Percodan addiction, in fact, after surviving open-heart surgery, cancer, pulmonary fibrosis, diabetes, and arthritis, he's lost 74 pounds, and he looks great. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Thanks today to engineer Doug Sugertz. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time.